This is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Canary. Thanks for joining us. Every year for the past five or so years, we've partnered with Florida Gulf Coast University and the Naples Discussion Group to bring conversations with speakers that they've brought to town to our listeners on this show. The FGCU Provost Seminar Series talks happen on Thursdays, so they stop by the studio while they're on campus, and then the Naples Discussion Group talks happen that Friday. This has created a sort of grab bag of expertise and the ability to highlight various dimensions of the world around us on this show. Last week, the speaker was Dr. Luis Martinez Fernandez. He's a distinguished historian, author, and is Pegasus Professor of History at the University of Central Florida in Orlando, where he specializes in Caribbean, Latin American, and Latino-Hispanic history. He's taught at UCF since 2004 and is a recognized expert on Cuban history. He was born on the island in 1960 and lived there briefly before his parents left the country during the early days of the revolution. Dr. Martinez Fernandez has published at least eight books, including Key to the New World, A History of Early Colonial Cuba in 2019, and Revolutionary Cuba, A History in 2014. He was also a nationally syndicated columnist. The talk Dr. Martinez Fernandez was giving at FGCU last week was titled Chiseled Out of Stone and Cast Out of Bronze, A History of the Caribbean as Told by Its Statues. But because of recent events in South and Central America and the Caribbean and in Iran and the Middle East and other parts of the world and how it's all connected, we didn't talk about statues, but instead began our wide-ranging conversation with his most recent book, When the World Turned Upside Down, Politics, Culture, and the Unimaginable Events of 2019 to 2022. Let's hear that now. Dr. Luis Martinez Fernandez is Pegasus Professor of History at University of Central Florida. Welcome to the show, Luis.
Thank you very much, Mike.
So the title of your talk today, or what is the topic of your talk today?
The title is Chiseled Out of Stone and Cast Out of Bronze. It's a history of the Caribbean as told by its statues. You know, statues have lives of their own. They're erected. Sometimes they're vandalized. Sometimes they're knocked down. They change over time. So I'm using the statues as windows into the history of the Caribbean, various topics, enslavement, for example, the Cuban Revolution. It's fun.
Is this part of a new research project or area of interest or book you're working on or anything like that?
No, I'm working on something else, actually, which is very different from what I've done in the past. It's a history of food and ingredients in the Napoleonic era.
Wow. Your interests are diverse.
Yes, they are.
Your 2023 book, was that the most recent book that you published?
Yes.
Was titled When the World Turned Upside Down, Politics, Culture, and the Unimaginable Events of 2019 through 2022. It's a bunch of essays and columns, as I understand it. A summary I found for that said, over the past 5 years, the world has witnessed several unimaginables about which the author felt compelled to write. What were those unimaginables?
Well, so many things happened almost all at the same time. The COVID pandemic, which really transformed the world. On the other hand, the Floyd killing in Minnesota that sparked a worldwide movement, Black Lives Matter, which already existed, but this accelerated it. We have developments in the United States, political developments, different government with different orientation. We had the acceleration of political tensions in this country. It began to appear as if we were preparing for a civil war. One of the things that I explore in that book is the parallelisms of the antebellum and political developments in this country since 2012.
I watched a YouTube video where you said that the parallels are pretty striking.
Yes, they are. I mean, you look at statistics, for example, no? The same percentage of foreign-born residents that we have today, roughly the same as it was in the antebellum, sectionalism, the demise of the moderates, which we saw right before the Civil War, and we've seen the moderates really you know, not playing the roles that they used to play of moderation and dialogue. And so dramatic things that I never thought I would write about or live actually through. And I'll tell you that, you know, I'm a historian. I write books that has its own tempo. But when you become a nationally syndicated columnist, there's no it's Friday 7:30 and you have to click the send button.
The wheel keeps turning.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have to make sure that, first of all, you have something important to talk about, that you research it, and then that you write it and rewrite it and polish it and play with it for a few days. It became a little bit draining, not just because of the tempo of that activity, but also because of the things that I was writing about.
Since 2023, we've had some other unimaginables, I think would be fair to say.
Yes, even more so. I mean, we have the election of Donald Trump to a second term. We've seen dramatic changes in domestic policy, certainly in foreign policy, the kinds of things that we're seeing in my area of expertise, which is the Caribbean, the extraction of Maduro from the presidency of Venezuela. And now it appears that Cuba might be next. Everything indicates in that direction. First of all, the crisis in Cuba has become aggravated. They've never really had a good time, economically speaking, but when you reach the point that there's no fuel for airplanes to that are landing and or flying out, that's very serious. And when there's no fuel, the pumps for water don't work, and you have to purchase the oil. And right now, as you know, the prices are shooting up. So hospitals, Cubans used to brag about their health system, but hospitals are just disastrous.
I watched another video where you were talking about the protests that were happening in Cuba in 2021 and how they were relatively unprecedented, or maybe unprecedented. There are protests similar to that happening like right now, right?
Yes, that's very true. They're not as organized as that one in 2021, but they don't have a leader that you can pinpoint. But they're spontaneous, and they're happening every single night in towns and cities throughout the island. A few months ago, we would see maybe 50 or 60 in a neighborhood banging pots and pans. What we're seeing now is some of them are into the high hundreds and putting buildings on fire and sabotage and graffiti. These things were unheard of, which leads me to understand that the Cuban people, which had it for a long time, now really have had it, and they've lost the fear of going out and mobilizing in the streets.
When the United States went into Venezuela, it seemed at least initially that part of the calculus or part of the explanation was that they were supporting the Venezuelan people, but it doesn't seem like things have changed that much. When we went into Iran a week and a half ago, President Trump said, "Rise up." That hasn't happened yet because that's still a huge conflagration. If there was a move made toward Cuba, could there be a way forward for the Cuban people that could be – could it be a beneficial thing or not? Like, you're the expert on it. I don't know.
Well, honestly, things are so bad. The country's paralyzed. Children are not going to school. Fridays, they don't have school anymore. That's all related to the energy crisis. So it can't get worse. Really, at this point, it can't get any worse. People are desperate. Most – you know, Cuba, they don't have surveys and public opinion studies. They don't have that. But my sense is that maybe 90 or more percent of the people just want to see the end of the regime. Díaz-Canel is not popular. He's disliked. He doesn't have the revolutionary credentials or the legitimacy of that revolutionary generation that the Castros belong to. And he's so disconnected and out of touch that people just want to see him out. Now, how that happens, that's tricky because I think it's going to be something negotiated. You know, Marco Rubio has a desire, a personal desire, to see the end of communism in Cuba. It's very personal for him and those around him. In the case of Trump, I mean, he's known for not having ideology, really. It's whatever is happening and whatever he heard last that moves him. But I think Marco Rubio is going to be pushing very, very hard for this. And I would be very attentive to the month of October. That might be an opportunity for, you know, really shaking the regime with U.S. pressures. I don't think it's going to require an invasion. I think there might be a deal with some of the military high-ranking officers. They have the weapons, and that may lead to a temporary military government that can call on elections within 6 months or so. I'm excited because, you know, I was born into the Cuban Revolution. I'm 67 now.
You were born when it was like in its second year. Yes. Post-revolution.
Yes. I don't have any memories of my own, but I've spent 40 years studying Cuba and the Cuban Revolution. So, yeah, but something will happen.
Two-part question. What is it about October? And October's a long way away when it comes to how history is evolving right now. But what is it about October?
Well, the elections, the midterm elections in this country are in November.
Huh. I have a few other things I want to ask you about. Shield of the Americas Coalition. What do you know about the Shield of the Americas Coalition?
I only heard about it when
it's only been around for about 6 days, they had their first summit on March 7th. It's a bunch of right-wing South and Central American countries who Trump has brought together. Like, what are your thoughts on that notion?
Well, I understand that the goal ostensibly is to stop the flow of drugs into this country and having shared intelligence and collaboration with other countries in the region. I'm not sure what's going to happen to that. You know, we had DOGE, which was a great thing, apparently, and then it lasted very, very short time. And then you have to ask the question, who's in charge of that? Kristi Noem.
What are your thoughts as a political historian who studies that region, the fact that Mexico, Brazil, Venezuela, and Colombia, which have governments on the left, aren't being involved?
And those are some of the most important countries.
And they contribute
yes.
A great percentage of the narcotics that it's ostensibly about, as I understand it.
That's correct. And if they're not on board, you know, they're part of what's called the pink tie in Latin American politics. Pink is not as strong as red, communist, but, you know, progressive, leftist. It's important to keep in mind, and I need to remind people of this, that the fact that a government is of the right doesn't mean that it's authoritarian. That it's of the left, it doesn't mean that it's liberal. We have illiberal democracies. But I think, you know, if you look at the map today, the red tie or the pink tie, I should say, is rising. And part of that has to do with, you know, people who are upset with neoliberalism, which hasn't panned out, and it has caused enormous misery in many countries in Latin America.
After the Venezuela, first of all, what were your thoughts on the way they removed Maduro? I mean, it was pretty – it was not something you'd expect to hear on the news.
No.
The way it unfolded.
No. It was surgical. Apparently, it was done with few casualties, although reports say that around 30 Cubans who were the guards around Maduro died in this confrontation. I'm not really sure whether that's going to lead to anything else better. I think that the Venezuelan leftist leadership has learned a lesson that the United States under Trump is willing to step in, if contradicted, at the drop of a hat. But as far as changes, I know the Venezuelan people in the diaspora are very happy with that happening. As a Cuban, I'd be very happy to see the Díaz-Canel regime end and would like to see them go off into exile. But then that's me, you know.
After the removal of Maduro, President Trump had that meeting with all the oil executives saying that they're going to go down there, and they seem to be, you know, not excited by that prospect. Oil is now above $100 a barrel. Does more valuable oil maybe make that more attractive?
Yes. What I've read is that the infrastructure in Venezuela as far as oil refining and oil extraction is dated. It's not in good shape. And that it would require many billions of dollars of U.S. capital to invest in that before we begin to see the results of the oil production in large numbers.
I watched a video on PBS that you were half of with somebody else. It was about the Cuban protests that were happening in 2021. The first gentleman who spoke talked about the way digital media, social media connectivity was helping to allow that. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts as somebody who studies history now that we live in a world where because of AI tools, mm-hmm. You know, we literally can't trust anything we see anymore? I mean, that was like, ooh, that's going to be a thing. But that's really a thing now. We really need to make sure what we watch is real. What are your thoughts on that?
That's very true. I remember back when the Solidarity Movement in Poland, I was watching the news, American news, and there was a clip from Russia. And they had somebody that appeared to be Lech Walesa, but he looked very strange to me. I mean, you could tell. And they were parading him on TV, and Walesa, or this fake Walesa, was asking for the workers to return to work. That was before deep fake that we have today. You know, it really cuts both ways. On the one hand, technology allows governments and repressive governments to have greater surveillance. They know almost anything about any one of us that they want to find out. On the other hand, we've seen how the videos that spread, and last videos that I saw, Cuban protesters, several of them had phones and they were taking video of the protests. Those were the kinds of things that would never circulate before that. And now we're able to see that around the world. And as I suggested earlier, Cubans have lost fear. And that's the first step. It's like I remember in school, you know, you have bullies. And the moment you stop a bully in his tracks, then that was the end of the bullying. And I feel that Cubans, out of desperation, are beginning to mobilize in ways that we have never seen before.
You alluded to this about Cuba earlier, but what's unfolding with Iran and around the Middle East and the oil dynamic globally, it appears that there's at least a chance that we're going to have a real energy problem, if not in the coming weeks or longer. You know, that's obviously going to affect things here in the United States. It's going to mm-hmm. affect things everywhere. Besides Cuba, like South Central America, like how disruptive can that be to countries down there?
Well, there's some oil-producing countries, as you know. Mexico is one of them, Brazil as well. It's going to be very tough because these economies are really dangling by a thread in many cases, and it's going to cost a lot of pain for regular citizens of those countries. It's interesting because tomorrow I'm going to give a talk on authoritarianism in Latin America and what we saw during the Great Depression, that of course it began here and then in Europe, but it hit the countries of Latin America the most because they were export oriented. And when the Great Depression exploded, that meant that the commodity prices fell dramatically. immediately, whether you were exporting coffee or copper or oil or tin, any other precious metals even. And what we saw was great instability. 1930 and 1931 and 1932, in those 3 years alone, we had about 15 military coups because people were mobilized and the military took over in those countries, and it remained in place as in the form of dictatorships in some instances for many, many decades.
Populism, whether on the right or the left, relies on instability.
Yes.
And we are in an increasingly unstable world now.
Yes, that's true. And that was tested. There was a thesis by a historian at Stanford, John Johnson, about the middle sectors being a source of stability throughout Latin America and a source of democracy. Well, guess what? During the critical years of the late 60s and throughout the 70s, there were problems with inflation in many of these countries. I mean, it's hard for me to even say it, but you would go to a restaurant and you would buy something for lunch, and then when you came back the next day, it would be twice as much because the money was being devalued. And at that juncture, in countries that some which had very strong democratic traditions, I'm talking about Uruguay, Chile, some of the two most democratic countries, but also in Brazil and in Argentina, the middle classes mobilized and they supported the emergence of right-wing dictatorships in those countries. It's fascinating that the stabilizing segment of the population became destabilizing when their pockets were hit that hardly.
Another video I watched, or maybe it's one of them that I've already referred to, you said this was from 2020 or 2021, that you remain an idealist. It's 5 years, 6 years later. Do you remain an idealist?
Yes. I believe in ideas. And I discovered them when I entered the University of Puerto Rico in 1978. And as I like to say, I never left the classroom. I'm a professor. And I've always been in a university, never, you know, as a student and then as a professor. I believe in ideas, and that's one thing that ChatGPT cannot generate. ChatGPT is incapable of genius. It's mediocre. I tell my students, don't use it because you all sound the same. And in a competitive world, you're going to have to be able to stand out and do better than that. I don't use it that much. Sometimes I use it as a Wikipedia, which I always told my students, you have to double check what you see in Wikipedia. But with ChatGPT, you have to triple check.
You got to triangulate all that information, because even just one sentence could be completely la-la land. The rest of it, it could be a page of text of good information, and then just one like, oh, this book doesn't exist. You never know.
I was playing around with it a few years ago, and I said, write an essay in the style of Luis Martinez Fernandez. And it produced something that sounded like me to an extent, but sounded like me in a bad day, you know, not very creative and... They call it hallucinations also, as you know.
Yeah. So if I've got it right, you were born in Cuba. You were in Miami for a very little time. Then you were in Peru for 8 years.
8 years.
And then you were in Puerto Rico for all the way through like your master's.
Correct.
When was the last time you were in Puerto Rico? We haven't even brought it up really, even though it's off. Obviously something we could have spent a whole show talking about as well.
Yes. I'm fortunate because I have several homes. So Cuba is my home. Spain is my ancestral home. Peru is also home. The United States is home. Puerto Rico certainly is home. I just came back from the island in February, and very vibrant in the arts and culture. That's something that apparently, and we learned about that in Latin America during the crisis of the 60s, how the creativity of authors and the boom literary movement was so important. The same thing with filmmaking, with painting. Us creative types, and I'll include myself among them, get a lot of energy from times of crisis and times of instability.
Well, hopefully there's some of organically created art that's coming out of our times of instability now and not just stuff coming out of large language models.
Yes. The other day, I won't say where, I saw an exhibit of young artists and they had their booths and it was so cartoonish. It didn't seem serious. You know, drawings that little kids do and fairies and I don't know. I don't know what to blame on that, but certainly it's not creativity.
I read that your late father was a role model and that he was also a lover of history. What do you think he'd think of where we're at in the world today?
Oh, he'd be very upset. You know, now that you mention him, it's interesting. When I wrote Revolutionary Cuba, A History, I didn't have many friends before, but when the book came out, I had even fewer because it was a book in which I dared do what is almost academic suicide in the United States, which is write a critical history of the Cuban Revolution and the regime. And one of the book reviewers, somebody in England, wrote that my father had been a right-wing anti-Castro person. And, you know, the fun thing is when somebody writes a nasty review of your book, you get a chance to respond. Then I responded, so, well, you must know things that I don't know because that's not the man I knew. And he was actually a progressive man and he became more progressive with age. And even during the Bush administration, he wasn't happy with the things that he was seeing. So he rests now and is not subjected to the kinds of things that we're seeing. For a historian, all of this is exciting. But I guess for the historian, it's exciting. But I don't think we've seen much of what's coming. I'm surprised, you know. I was on campus today and I saw these vehicles that were delivering food for students, robots. And, you know, I never thought I would see things like that. I never thought that I would be driving from Orlando to this university and getting updates on exactly how many minutes I would be here. For young people, that's almost natural. But for those of us who grew up without that, it's sobering in a sense.
To a historian, this will probably you'll probably say all times are like this. But I feel like we are in historically alive times. Like every day, right now.
Yes.
Are what's the saying? Sometimes a decade happens in a day, and sometimes a day happens in a decade, or something like that. I feel like we're in the every day's a historic day. Is that from your perspective? Does it feel like that?
Yeah. Of course, as you know, every day is historic.
That's why I characterized it like that at the beginning, too, especially to you.
But certainly the amount of change and, you know, the Trump administration with its different approach to things, and there's great instability as far as the policy, and it's hard to keep track. And, you know, it gave me a lot of material when I was a columnist to write about the things that I was observing as far as U.S. policy domestically and abroad.
Well, we're pretty much out of time. Any other big picture things I didn't bring up that you're tracking right now besides statues in the Caribbean?
Well, I'm tracking food now.
Oh, yeah.
That's my next
book
project. And it's the way ideas come, and ChatGPT is incapable of this. So I like beef Wellington. It's one of my favorite dishes. And then one day I thought, and there's a Napoleon dessert. So right there you have the two protagonists of the Napoleonic Wars and Waterloo. And I created a menu. So the book with a tentative title, The Banquet of Waterloo, has 12 chapters. Each chapter represent a course in a 12-course meal. And I just finished the one on Martinique. Josephine Bonaparte, Napoleon's wife, was from Martinique.
When that comes out, I need a copy so I can have you back on the show.
Oh, please, yes.
I would love to read it. Dr. Luis Martinez-Fernandez is Pegasus Professor of History at University of Central Florida. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
If you missed any of the show, you can always hear episodes in their entirety on our website, wgcu.org/GCL, or you can subscribe to this show as a podcast, or you can find all of our episodes on the WGCU app. Our show today was produced by yours truly, with an FGCU student named Talon Tharp running the board. He's an Honors College ambassador. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Kniry. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM. We are NPR for Southwest Florida.